Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
So I wanted to address some of the criticism we've had, me specifically, although there's been some criticism of Ed, which we'll come on to, from the video we made last week to promote the electric car episode, which was basically me getting in the back of Ed's car as if he was an Uber driver and him driving around the block a little bit. And quite a few people came at me on social media for not wearing a seatbelt.
Yes.
You can see I try and stretch it across myself,
right,
but it won't
quite go.
Do you ever have that thing where you are in the back of a taxi or something and you worry that if you put the seatbelt on too far into the journey, they are going to think that it's in some way a criticism of their driving?
You're such an empathetic person. I mean, it's so... I felt that this week because of when we recorded something and I sort of texted you to say, you're definitely the most empathetic person I know. I
mean, it doesn't occur to you.
Well, I think it might vaguely occur to me, but it's so interesting.
I'm getting myself in knots about this stuff all the time. So anyway, apologies. It was really logistical and I feel bad about...
I'm being a bad
role model.
Yeah.
I'm worried that I'll go to jail and that'll be the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
And then I received a message from my friend Craig, who is a television screenwriter and director. And he sent me a text message saying, I just watched you and Ed in the car. Quite possibly the worst acting I've seen since Victor Kiam. Do you remember Victor Kiam and Remington Steele?
What did he say? I bought the company. I liked it so much,
right.
I bought the company.
Yeah. He said it's like watching Thunderbirds. He says, if you're still doing them in winter, I'll send you some cuprinol.
What's cuprinol?
You know, the stuff for treating wood. So,
is that true? I thought it was quite good.
I thought
Boris Johnson one was better.
Yeah, yeah. This was
Painting the Bus.
It's a very good impersonation.
Yeah.
You know, between that, your Tony Blair, your Gordon Brown. I mean, I really think...
You think I could be the new Rory Bremner?
A summer season in Blackpool beckons for you.
But as a sort of supporting act.
Yes,
probably.
Yeah. You wouldn't be the headliner. No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
So what are we talking about this week?
This week we're talking about women in sport. Last night was the final of the Women's World Cup, but because we're recording this before Sunday, we don't know which way it went. But it's been a big moment for women's sport in the UK. England got to the semi-finals, the Lionesses. 11.7 million people saw the semi-final against the US. Unfortunately, England lost, but it was the largest ever TV audience for women's football in the UK. And that is definitely progress because up till 1971, the FA banned women's teams from using their football grounds. At professional level, women's sport still gets nowhere near as much coverage and there's a big pay gap. At grassroots level, there's a large gender gap in participation in exercise and sport. And we're going to be talking about the United States, where there's a law called Title IX, which requires equal resources for men's and women's sports in education. And that might be a clue why women's soccer is so successful in the United States. It's really interesting that a legal change made in 1972 could have that effect. And we're going to be talking about what we can learn from the US and what else needs to be done here to achieve greater gender equality in sport. And I think this really matters because... I think it matters for girls and women having equal opportunities in sport, but I think it also matters for the kind of wider kind of gendered nature of our society.
I think this World Cup has made a big difference.
Definitely.
I got in a black cab the other day and the driver said, did you see the game today?
Yes.
Or are you watching the game tonight or whatever?
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, this feels like change. And in fact, in my own house... I was flicking through the channels. It was the Sweden versus Netherlands game. I was watching it with my wife and I said, we should just see if it goes to penalties. And she said, you would never watch this if it was men's football.
Interesting.
You were just doing it to prove what a good feminist you are.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So,
after all that, we are joined by comedian Robin Morgan with some ideas which could be reasons to be cheerful. What is your reason to be cheerful this week?
Well, I was on the train and I went to the buffet car and another bloke was coming to the buffet car, and he said, oh, you're ordering a bacon sandwich. And I was sort of not very amused by that.
Come on, never not funny.
But
it must never get old for you.
But I then got into a discussion with him, and he's a really fascinating bloke. His name's Alex Harris, and he is the regional secretary for a union called the United Road Transport Union. And believe it or not, this union was first the United Carters Association, as in people who worked on horses and cars. Anyway, he organises lorry drivers. He was himself a lorry driver. And we had an absolutely fascinating conversation. And I thought what was really interesting about it was that, it's not an easy area to organise in. Because it's quite sort of sole tradery.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, not sole tradery, but, it's quite individual.
Isolated. Yeah,
isolated.
Yeah.
I just thought, it just reminds you there are lots and lots, so many people across the country who just try and make lives better for people who, don't have much kind of help behind them and are, face quite big and quite sort of difficult sometimes employers.
Do you think he could arrange it for us to go in the secret lorry driver's bit at the motorway services?
What is the secret lorry driver?
I don't know, because you're not allowed in there unless you're a lorry driver.
Really?
They've got their own sort of VIP area.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and I think he could be our ticket into there.
You got it. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is that I went to Hebden Bridge. Now, we went and did the show from Hebden Bridge a year ago, you might remember.
Yes.
And
you went to Adrift.
I did my other podcast, Adrift, yes. Which is sort of a humour podcast around social awkwardness.
Yes.
We went and did a live show in Hebden Bridge at the same venue, the Trades Club, which is just this
yes.
great place. Because it is a podcast about social awkwardness, the audience it attracts are sort of self-confessed socially awkward people. So I got a huge laugh by going on stage at the beginning and saying, okay, we want to start by, if we can all take it in turns to stand up and say something about yourself.
Did they all do it?
No, of course not. That was the joke. Like they are the least likely people in the world to do something like that. But we had fun. It was good, and it was great to go back
to
Hebden Bridge.
We love Hebden Bridge, don't we?
Yeah, it's a really special place. And speaking of live shows, our next live date is prefer to be metric, centimetering ever closer. We are going to be at the Grand in Clapham in South London. We'd love for you to come along. It's going to be a Sunday evening
It could be our 100th episode.
I mean, we've got a 100th episode coming up. Should this be the special one?
Yeah, I think it's going to be special.
It's regardless of whether it's 100th, 98th,
please,
or 106th.
I don't want to be just like alone in Clapham with Jeff. So
thanks, Ed.
Can you buy tickets, please?
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
I'm delighted to say that we are now joined on the line by Baroness Sue Campbell, Director of Women's Football at the Football Association. Sue was chairperson of UK Sport from 2003-2013. I had the pleasure of meeting Sue during the 2012 Olympics. Sue, look, let me just say, first of all, I know you'll be incredibly disappointed by what happened in the semi-final, but I think we've just been talking. It's really had an amazing effect here. I think it has been a transformative thing, and we're all incredibly proud of the Lionesses.
Well, that's great. Thank you for that. And we don't underestimate that. I think the problem when you're a performance athlete, though, is that all of that is great, but it's not what you came out here to do. But I, from a bigger perspective, look at it and think, my goodness, what an impact it's all had. And the challenge of that now for me at the FA is to turn that inspiration and that interest into something that's sustainable and long term.
And what are the ideas for doing that? How do you see that going?
Well, at one end, we're going to try. We're going to be working in 6,000 schools from September, trying to get girls' football available to girls of all ages, right through primary and secondary, just to give them an experience of the game and an opportunity to play. Right now, a little boy of primary school age would definitely be playing football in schools, whereas with girls it's a bit of a postcode lottery and it's a very small percentage that are getting an opportunity. And we think it's important that it's our national game, that every girl gets a chance to be introduced to it and hopefully enjoy it, not necessarily ending up being a Lioness, but enjoys it and gets involved in it. So that's kind of trying to get the foundations of inspiration into participation. We're then doing a huge amount of work on coach development, trying to improve the coaching, both men and women working in the women's game. And then I think at the top end, it's how do we translate that amazing audience into people attending regularly our Super League and Championship and women's club football?
And in 2017, you launched quite an ambitious game plan for growth for women's football when you took over. Is what you're talking about a continuation of that strategy? Where does that hope to get to?
Yeah, the first strategy that you're talking about has a lifeline that finishes April next year. And it was about doubling participation, doubling the fan base, and moving to a more successful international position so that we could win the World Cup in 2023. Obviously, with Phil's appointment, we...
That's Phil Neville, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We were ambitious to win it in 2019. We will have achieved those objectives. And, you know, in many ways, we'll have exceeded them far more than we could have anticipated.
And on this episode, we're talking more broadly about promoting women's sport generally, so in football, but elsewhere as well. More broadly, what are the kind of things that you think need to be done?
You and I have talked about this many times. My view is that unless we get a proper investment and structure for school, physical education and sport, whether it's football or any other sport, we're not going to have the foundation on which we can build. So for me, we had a period where we began to build an infrastructure for school sport that was beginning to be the envy of the world.
Yes.
And then, you know, as you and I both know, it disappeared. But we have got to do more for school sport. We have got to embed, for not just sporting reasons, but for physical and emotional health reasons, we've got to embed physical activity and sport into young people's lives. The only place you're going to do that consistently for all young people is in school. And I think physical literacy should be as important for our youngsters as literacy and numeracy. Why do we think it's not important anymore? It's more important than it's ever been.
And do you think, finally, Sue, this can be a turning point? I mean, we haven't had this kind of attention on women's sport, certainly not in my memory. I mean, it's obviously disappointing that we didn't win, but this, it feels like this could be a transformative moment if government, media, broadcasters and so on step up, doesn't it?
Absolutely it does. And, you know, we no sooner get home than the World Cup netball starts in Liverpool. The women cricketers are playing the Aussies in a series right now, one-day series. Our women's rugby players have done really well in the past. Our hockey players won gold in Rio. This has to be the moment when women's sport really gets the support that it absolutely, truly deserves. And I hope we've played our part in making that possible.
Well, you absolutely have, Sue Campbell. We're all incredibly proud of you and the team. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, I'm delighted to say that we're now joined on the line by Christine Newhall, who is Assistant Professor of Kinesiology at SUNY Cortland, New York, and co-author of the Title IX blog. Thank you so much for joining us, Christine.
You're welcome.
So, Title IX, tell our listeners about this. I've been obsessed with this for some time. I think it was introduced in 1972. Can you just explain what it is and what the impact has been?
It's a federal law that was part of the educational amendments, and it bans discrimination on the basis of sex in educational institutions that receive federal monies.
Before we talk about its impact, maybe what was the context in which it came about?
It's very much part of the liberal, what we currently call the second wave of feminism in the United States, which was attacking or addressing discrimination and inequalities in various structures, and education, the educational institutions was one of them. So the specific context in which it emerged was that the woman who is kind of considered the godmother of Title IX, who just passed this past year, Bernice Sandler, she had a PhD and she was looking for a tenure track position and she could never get one. And so she felt that she was being discriminated against on the basis of her sex and felt, one, that there should already be a law and was surprised to find there wasn't one. And so she worked specifically with the Women's Equity Action League in the United States to get this law passed. And it did in 1972. So it was meant to address discrimination more broadly.
And Richard Nixon was president at the time.
Correct, yeah.
What impact has Title IX had on women's sport in the United States?
I would say the biggest impact is the dramatic increase in women and girls playing sports. So, according to the Women's Sports Foundation, their 2016 numbers, which are pretty accurate still, there was a 545% increase in women playing college sports and a 990% increase in girls playing high school sports.
That is amazing. We obviously, in the midst of the Women's World Cup of soccer, certainly my perception as somebody who went to school at various points in the US is that, you know, girls' soccer was just a really much bigger thing. Is Title IX part of that? Did it predate Title IX?
There's pretty compelling evidence to show that the success of women's soccer in the US is due to Title IX, because it was, I would say, an easy sport for colleges to add, right? Because what they needed was to get their numbers of participation opportunities more equitable with the men. And soccer is a relatively cheap sport.
How interesting. That's so interesting. I was discussing this with my boys who are 8 and 10, and that's what they said. I said, right, you know, we think that it might well be that this Title IX's had a big impact on soccer. And they said, oh, yeah, because you don't need so much equipment for football or soccer, as you call it, as compared to baseball or, you know, basketball or whatever.
So what more needs to be done then?
Well, participation, we love those numbers, right? But girls and women's participation is still below boys and men's. And, you know, there's an argument that it's because girls are less interested in sports. And then, of course, the counter argument is, well, when society discourages girls, especially from playing certain sports like contact sports, you know, that sends a message to girls about what they can and should do. So it's society that's depressing those numbers, not certainly interest, right? Or putting barriers in girls' ways.
And do you think the UK, I know Title IX doesn't do everything, it sounds like, but do you think the UK can learn from the US? Should we have a Title IX here?
You know, if the goal is to just increase participation overall for the purpose of merely participating in sports because we think that sports are valuable, then yes, a version of Title IX, which says, you know, regardless of how much it costs and regardless of what's popular, you need to provide equitable opportunities to boys and girls, then absolutely.
Christy Newhall, thanks so much for enlightening us on Title IX. It's been great to hear from you.
You're welcome.
So with us now in my loft, we have Katie Huey, who is founder of Hackney Laces, a community football club set up in 2011, and Kate Nicholson, who is head of insights and innovation at Women in Sport. Hello, both. Thank you for coming.
Hi.
Kate, I thought we could start with you, and maybe you can give us a sort of an oversight of what the current scale of the gender gap in sport at elite level and at grassroots level is.
Yeah, so if we start thinking about it at grassroots level, it starts really young. Between the ages of 5 and 16, you've got 14% of girls who reach the recommended activity level. So that's only 14. Now, that's 20% for boys. So there's definitely a gender gap there. There's work to do on both, I would say. And by the time they get into teenage years, that drops to 10% of girls. So what we're seeing is that gender gap starting very early. Girls are not taking part in sport at that age, at that younger age, and particularly not in team sport. So that's where it all starts, and then that continues to track
through
time.
What are the underlying reasons for it?
It's really complex, actually. I think there's a number of different reasons. I think there's personal reasons. So society and gender stereotypes tend to put sport outside of girls' sort of natural DNA, if you like. So there is about challenging some of those stereotypes. I think there's lots that happen going through puberty and when girls are growing up that are quite negative and actually create a really negative feeling about sport. And I think that's something that's hard to change through life. I hear sort of 40 and 50 year olds often referring back to a experience they had at school.
That's me.
Yeah, exactly. And an experience they had at school and saying, I'm not sporty. And you think, well, that was 30, 40 years ago. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that happen in that younger age group that we need to change. If you look at the elite level, we did some work on sport in the media, and only at the maximum level, it was 10% of all sports coverage was women's sport. and over 80% was men's sport. There was some mixed coverage, but that seems quite shocking, really, considering that you've got a population of 51-49. You know, it doesn't seem to match up somehow.
And does that gap not exist not just in the coverage on television, but in things like the pay gap as well and revenue from advertising?
Yeah, I think women's sport, we've heard that it was about 0.4% of the sponsorship and investment, of all investment. So that's the sort of level that was a couple of years ago now. I think it has increased, but from a low base. So you're not getting the money coming into sport in the same way as men's sport. And that filters down, that's not only at elite level, but that filters down into the infrastructure and facilities and opportunities that girls and women have at the grassroots level as well.
But the advertising industry must have just had an enormous wake-up call in the last few weeks.
About time, I think, actually. Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, it's been a bit of a surprise maybe to them. Not a surprise to me, because I think, you know, we've always known that there's been hugely exciting sport for women going on. It just wasn't getting the scale. And I have to say, credit to the BBC. They have put on all the games for the football and, you know, the audiences they've had, you know, 11.7 million for that final, semi-final was, sorry, wishing it was the final. that semi-final was absolutely staggering.
Katie, can you tell us about Hackney Laces then? You set it up to give opportunities for girls to play football. Can you tell us a bit about the story behind it and what the spirit of it is?
Yeah, so actually, Laces was formed not very far from here. So Stoke Newington Common, I used to live around the corner, and I'd be coming home from my own football training and lots of girls would approach me.
You're a serious football player.
Serious? I'm a weekend warrior.
Right, right.
I love playing five-a-side, 11-a-side. Yeah. But I'd just be training with my team, which was in Islington. I'd come home in Hackney and these girls would approach me and they'd say, "Where do you play? Can I play?" I couldn't take them to my women's team. And so I got on the phone, I called around, I called all neighbouring boroughs, I called the council, I spoke to different charities, and I couldn't find a place for these girls. And they started growing. So at first it was two, and then there were five. And then I said, "Well, I'm a licensed FA coach, I'll coach you in Stoke Newington Common." And then it kind of got to a point where it hit that scale where I realised, like, probably need liability insurance, probably need to do something about it, because there just wasn't a club as Kate mentioned, that cohort of girls, there just wasn't a place for them to play.
What ages then play at Hackney Laces?
We take all ages because we need to get as many girls and women into sport as possible. But our main cohort is 13 to 17.
And how many girls do you have playing there now?
We have about 60.
Amazing.
And we can detect a North American accent with you. It's the good one, not the bad one.
Thank you.
I say this as someone who's married to an American. Do you think sort of women's football is taken much more seriously?
Well, I was going to ask. Yeah, did you play in school in Canada?
Yeah. So Hackney Laces is not innovative. It's my childhood imported to the UK. Right. Literally, I grew up with all the opportunities to play. I played mixed. Soccer was for everyone. It wasn't a thing that was gendered. It wasn't a thing that I didn't have the same opportunities. I went to university on a football scholarship. That's like a normal thing back home. And then I came here and I couldn't find a team to play for myself. And I thought,
has that always been a tradition in Canada, as far as you know? That girls play soccer and etc.
Yes, culturally, active lifestyles are a big part of, I think, the Canadian.
Yeah.
We have space.
Yeah.
It's encouraged. Also, PE is mandatory in schools until you're 17.
Mm. Right.
And there is a difference.
Jess looking slightly horrified.
I just always wanted a note from my mum.
Yeah, I mean, I think here, if you look at primary schools, you've not got specialist teachers, mainly in primary schools, teaching sport. And I think that physical literacy needs to happen early. And I think girls don't have some of the outside opportunities to build that literacy. And then they're always on the back foot. So I think, you know, if they feel like they have to be the very best to actually get into these football spaces with the boys, then you're getting far fewer girls moving forward.
Well, your research focuses on the importance of changing perceptions of sport for teenage girls, I think. What have you discovered in that research?
Yeah, so I think one of the big things there is that we often talk about girls as one group. What do we do for girls? And I think that is sometimes, you know, the difficulty, because then we start to project what we think it is that girls want. So what we did with that research, we went right back to starting research from their lives and what's important in their lives to really get underneath the surface of how we can make change. So it's not about what the sport tweaks to make it a bit better. So I think there's one big thing that was there is the spectrum that you've got. So by the time girls get to about 12 or 13, you've got some that have already disengaged completely with sport. They've just had a bad experience and they're just not feeling included in the whole sports arena. You've got a group of girls who start to realise that actually it's only if you're good, and they fail to find where they can play for fun. And I think the sports sector is probably pretty good at catering for that top end of girls who are sporty, and there's lots of opportunities right. for them there. But where's that middle right. band? How do we can't just take away barriers. It's also about inspiring them in a way that they feel that this is something they want to give up their free time to do.
This is a kind of rather obvious point, but I guess it is worth making. The cultural expectation is still, isn't it? Boys are expected to play sport and girls aren't.
Last night, I watched my partner run a 5K in Battersea Park. There were 15,000 people running it. And as people are coming through the finishing chute, the commentator was going, "There's a woman! There's a woman! Oh my God, there's a woman! She's coming in at 20 minutes!" And they spoke, like, just, it was astounding because it was like, yeah, there's a woman, but she's fast for a person, not for a woman.
Yeah.
But it's so ingrained, I think, in our right. cultural psyche that it's not a space or not a thing that women do, that it's seen as like a specimen that this amazingly fast 5K runner came through. And
also, you know, just in the history, the FA banned clubs from allowing women to play on their grounds because football was unsuitable for females, and that ban was in place until 1971. Now,
I know.
You know, 1971 is nearly 50 years ago now, but that's still relatively recent history, isn't it?
And you've got that sort of almost making right the wrong that's coming through. So you've still got people who perhaps are in clubs who can't see the world has changed, and they're still harping back to that. If you look back in the 1920s and earlier, women's football was big.
Yeah. And through this kind of the legacy of the institutions banning women from playing, even though it was 50 years ago, you see it play out day in, day out on a grassroots level. Try booking a pitch. That is the hardest thing
Go
for
on,
me
to explain.
Do.
Explain.
So I'll call somewhere to book a pitch, be it at a school, a council-run pitch, a privately-owned pitch. Let's put costs aside yeah. for a second. I'll be told we've block booked it for the next 12 weeks for a men's league. And you go, so there's no evening bookings. No, there's zero. Okay, so how can I get a booking? Oh, you can have Friday at 10 p.m. for girls and women to play football. And it's because of these legacy bookings that go on and have been in there that you
amazing,
just can't access the space. And then you're like, fine, we'll just go to the park. No ball games. Like, the provision of space in itself. And I recognise that we're in London, but that is one of the biggest things.
And that wouldn't have happened in Canada.
No. So you can play ball games anywhere.
How do you break that stranglehold then?
You make good friends, you build a community around you, and you just never leave. It becomes a problem with scale. But with that, you kind of see what you can find nearby and who those allies are.
Right. I mean, I think there's something really interesting about this, which is that it's the stereotypes and the sort of discrimination stops girls and women from playing sport. But then it also works the other way, which is that the more, in other words, if you can get women and girls playing sport, it also changes the stereotypes more widely, I think. Mm. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
like there'll be some people listening to this who, sorry to use you, but I mean, Jeff's not great, doesn't like, you know, not like into sport that much. And so you might.
That much, that's.
and you might think, well, you know, okay, so that sounds bad, but why does this, you know, maybe it just matters for sport and it's kind of an issue. But I kind of instinctively feel it's got a wider implication for society as it like goes beyond sport.
We have a few principles of how we approach our sessions and our clubs. So Hackney Laces was the first, but we also have South London Laces and Limehouse Laces. One of our principles is wherever possible, play in public, because people need to see you playing.
Oh,
they need
right.
to see you in parks. They need to see you in spaces. Some of our sessions require us to be behind closed doors because some Somali women who train with us don't want to be seen for their culture. Another one of those principles, though, is all three of our clubs have T-shirts that say this is what a footballer looks like.
Oh,
and everyone wears it.
Right.
Yeah, because anyone can be a footballer. Anyone can look like a footballer. We give them out. I should have brought you guys some.
Could you have one of those? Could you have one of those t-shirts?
It's just a challenge.
I think I could be done under Trey's descriptions.
And
I think
you can
really good.
Yeah, and I think you can challenge them in so many ways. That is absolutely brilliant. I'm going to take that idea and steal it with pride.
Yes. Let's go to mass production.
But I also think, I mean, we're doing a programme at the moment with daughters and dads. And again, it's another way of just looking at how we talk about stereotypes. So again, it's with dads with daughters under 10, and it's helping them get active, but also sort of really thinking about how strong their daughters are and rethinking how they can take part in sport. It's just a way of them rethinking sometimes what their initial thoughts are. Because we often hear with dads, it's like, oh, I really want a son to take him to the football so I can play football with him in the park. And, you know, we just want them to sometimes think,
with me,
what about
like,
the rest?
Oh, no, it's a son. What if he would get to football?
Well, exception maybe.
You're like making your own contribution to breaking down the stereotypes of our society. That's why, I know we know why, that's why you're doing it. So we've heard earlier on about the US and Title IX. Which ensures equal funding of sports for men and women. Do you think we should have something like that in the UK?
It's interesting, isn't it, how long ago that was
that
it came in. So, you know, 72, you sort of think, has it taken us this long to actually think of anything like that? And you wonder if there's something even more positive that we can do, because we do have to right the wrong. But really now, with what's going on in women's sport, should it not be obvious that this has to happen?
And what about different stages of women's lives beyond childhood and young adulthood? What more needs to be done to sort of promote and encourage women's sport?
Yes, and I think what we were saying was that what happens in those younger years actually can create a really negative feeling towards sport. We see women badge themselves as sporty or not sporty.
And proportionately, I think it's 20% of them say sporty, 20% ginger, 20% baby, 20% scary, and 20% spice. They're abandoned the 90s.
I got there after the second one. But yes, I think then it's harder to actually create those opportunities and to encourage that motivation to do that. But there's different times in their lives when you've got that little window to do more. So I think, again, when women have children themselves, I think there's a real opportunity there for a bit of a virtuous circle of the girls and sons. Seeing their mums active is really positive, and equally seeing their children active can have an effect there. So we see a big dynamic with mums and daughters, with dads and daughters, and also it's the whole family, because I think the boys and the sons and the dads are all part of the solution.
I'm now worried that we're reinforcing the stereotypes in my family.
Well, you haven't got a daughter.
No, but it's like me and the boys go and, you know, we watch the cricket or the football. Actually, Justine was saying to me that she had the sort of ultimate feminist dilemma, because the Lionesses were on in one of the earlier rounds and it was quite late. And so the children saw it as a way, as sort of partly as a ruse to get sort of, you know, kind of to crash bedtime. Through bedtime. And she, if it had been a men's football match, she would have said no. But she thought, well, I can't really say no, because here I've got my two boys, 8 and 10, who are wanting to watch the Lionesses, you know, past their bedtime. So I've got to say yes.
And there's the added advantage, isn't it? Yeah. You know, there's all sorts of opportunities to exploit.
So we have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, where I am the benign ruler, setting aside my lack of sportiness. If I was to make you join,
are you not realizing how bad this is? The male patriarchy. Here we are talking about, it's not just, you haven't just got a sort of dictatorial problem here now. You've got a sort of male patriarchy kind of, you know, DEFCON 5
but
here.
I'm not fulfilling any stereotypes. I'm helping. I'm part of the solution.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay, fine.
Yeah. If I was to make you joint ministers for sport, what is the first thing you do on day one with regards to women and sport?
Well, a big one is on the visibility piece. So, again, referring back to my home nation, in Canada, this is going to sound quite provincial, but 60% of radio has to be domestic. So you have to play Canadian artists, and that's why you have Justin Bieber, Celine Dion, Shania Twain,
how
loads of famous Canadians.
Can we not concentrate on Arcade Fire and Leonard Cohen?
That would have been a lot cooler.
How interesting.
But in terms of broadcast, BBC played all the games, which was amazing, but it was free TV. You have viewership numbers up really high because it's free.
Million,
so people can watch it because they don't need certain things to be able to see that. But also, you're getting to see more, and it's not in competing with the Premier League. And I think there's something to be done around viewership and allowing that to play out and representation in the media.
For me, I think it's about some investment, but it's not, I think it's an investment across schools and local authorities. And we were here from Katie. If there's all this momentum now and girls wanting to play football, wanting to play other sports, we've got netball next week. If we haven't got the facilities there for them to play and we haven't got the coaches there to coach them, it's going to wane again. So mine would be that investment into making sure that facilities in school and outside school have more of an equal footing for women and girls.
Brilliant. Kate Nicholson and Katie Huey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
What do you think then?
Well, as you know, sport isn't my thing. I feel very ill-informed.
Well,
on
that's
the subject,
okay, but you're
generally
demolishing the gender stereotypes. We've established that.
Yes.
You're doing your bit.
But, you know, I always think representation is enormously important. And as you got at before, it spills over beyond just the confines of sport. So I just think it's exciting. I think, as I said at the beginning of the episode, it was exciting to get into a London black cab and have the driver say to me, you're watching the match tonight, talking about women's football. That feels like progress to me.
I mean, it feels like there's a long way to go, though. You know, the media, the BBC have made progress, but only 10%. This thing about the pitches that Katie was saying, that's just a problem. I mean, I really hope it is a moment, because I think, I honestly think this has wider implications on people who are just enthusiasts about sport or want women to be able to have access to sport. It's, unless if you leave corners of your country where there is still significant gender discrimination, then I think it sort of has a contagion effect on the rest of your country, if you see what I mean. And that's why this stuff really matters.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Let us know what you think. Have you been inspired by this year's Women's Football World Cup? Have you got ideas around women's sport? Have you got experiences you can share with us? Do email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Cheerful Podcast, or you can find us on Facebook. Our page is facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. This first one comes from James Thomas, and it's about last week's episode on electric vehicles.
Well, lots of response on that.
Yeah, loads and loads. I had an interesting tweet, actually, which I couldn't find. I was just scrolling back, but it's gone too far back in my timeline, about the waiting time for an electric vehicle. That's something I'd like
really
to find out a bit more. Like somebody who really wanted to buy one.
Interesting.
But you can't just go in a showroom and buy all of them. I'm sure there are exceptions.
Well,
Jaguar
Land Rover's just announced today they're building electric cars.
That's
in
great.
The UK. So.
Yeah. Anyway, lots of response to that. This comes from James, who says, I really enjoyed the recent podcast about the topic of electric cars, especially because I'm obsessed with cars. And this is what got me thinking. People who love cars are known as petrol heads. But what would they be known as if the world contained only electric cars? Volt brains?
That's good, volt brains.
Electron nuts? Cable noggins? You think he started well with volt brains and then
volt brains is good.
Okay.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I do. Very much. I like cable noggins.
It's sort of got me thinking now, so anyway.
Secondly, a new EU law that has recently come into place states that electric vehicles should make a sound so they can be heard by pedestrians. As electric cars are silent, we have an opportunity to choose the noise our vehicles make. Personally, I would go for a Star Wars TIE fighter, or perhaps even a melodic, continuous Ed Miliband. Can you give us an imagine that on a loop instead of a car engine.
Spark plug?
Yeah. Do they make a sound? Oh, I see. You're back on the things, aren't you? Yeah,
but you have spark plugs in petrol cars.
Yeah. I still think.
What's an electric thing? Electricity. Come on.
You keep thinking battery.
Battery. Oh, battery.
You keep thinking. I'll read out the rest of the email.
Yeah.
Okay. He says, what would you both choose as your electric car sound effect? Oh, this is a good question, isn't it? I'd have ice cream van chimes, I think.
Would you?
Yeah.
So it's like a ringtone thing, isn't it?
Yeah, because maybe that's what it'll become in the future.
I think I'd choose Edith Piaf's Je ne regrette rien.
je ne regrette rien. Don't you think it'd be great if you're driving down the road I think, without being flayed?
I think it would, but if it was your version rather than Edith Piaf.
Right, okay, fine.
He says, I have no doubt that the future is bright for the car and that petrol heads have lots of reasons to be cheerful. No,
I think people should email us in about what they would
choose. Exactly, yes. Yeah,
don't you think?
Yeah.
I think this is like we're setting off a whole new, like, you know, cul-de-sac. Right, this one comes from Nile Rodgers.
Freak out!
I guess that's a pop song. hi, both. I enjoyed the most recent episode on electric vehicles. I live in a flat with no off-street parking. I'd like to get an EV, but there's nowhere I could keep to charge it. What can we do to solve this? Fast charging, I think, is the thing. So, you know, you go to a petrol station, you fill up in 5 minutes. I think we're heading towards the road, you know, like 10-minute. Like fast charging.
Oh God, I'd love to be able to do that on my phone. Do you think they can introduce that as well?
Yeah, well, there are supposed to be those things that
really
do that. One other problem I find is the used car market for EVs is tiny, especially for new models with increased range, and we know about range anxiety. The only option is to buy new. A friend and I were discussing the environmental impact of scrapping perfectly working cars to buy an EV. Is driving an older internal combustion engine car a few more years until it's the end of its life better than scrapping early and buying an EV that is costly to produce in terms of materials, energy and emissions? Would love to see any studies. That's a good, really good point, actually. Somebody was also emailed in saying, couldn't you convert existing cars that we'd really missed out something important? But so there's lots to talk about. Finally, I drive to work because it's much cheaper over the year and faster than an annual train ticket. Well, that is definitely a problem. The car has the added bonus I can go anywhere else I want any time. Public transport would have to dramatically fall in price to make it financially sensible for me to get rid of the car. I think a lot of people are in the same boat. Thanks and keep up the good work, Niall.
And we received this email from Amy, who says, hi there, I just wanted to send a massive thank you. I'm an avid listener, never missing an episode yet. The last one on GDP was fantastic. As a single mother with two young children, I worked really hard to make a good life for us. A couple of years ago, after being disillusioned with the glory of money, I was working too hard and missing out on anything that gave me a sense of well-being. I realised that a life worth living comes from more than just cash. So many studies have shown that money alone cannot solve all problems. Lottery winners only have a boost in happiness for the first 3 months after a windfall, and as well as only incomes of up to 40k a year show a correlation with happiness, and all additional value after that income threshold is purely monetary because the individuals show no additional happiness themselves. I love the idea of modelling the goals and ambitions of a society on the betterment for all. And she finishes by saying, anyway, not to ramble, but I also wanted to say that from listening to this podcast and admittedly other influences, I've changed my degree pathway to public health from September.
We're having an impact.
Yes,
we're having an impact.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
And here with some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, comedian Robin Morgan. Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
And you're about to go to Edinburgh, and then did you just tell us 2 days after Edinburgh you have a baby on the way?
10 days, which makes it sound slightly less exciting, but it's still quite tight, isn't it? It's still quite a close-knit thing. So hopefully the due date is absolutely correct, but if not, I'll have to get on a plane and fly back home.
So your partner won't be in Edinburgh?
So she's going to come up with my son for the first 10 days, and then on my day off, I'm going to take them down to London on the train, fly back up. And then my mum and her mum are going to split the time the rest of the fortnight. We've got contingency plans. You both look incredibly worried. It's going to be fine, hopefully. But yes, she's...
Have you thought about...
Jeff will be there to deliver... Oh no, your wife won't be there for Jeff to deliver the baby.
But if you can get on a plane and come to London and deliver the baby, I'd be happy with that.
You're available for that, aren't you?
Hugely, yeah.
You're so multitasking.
Yeah. Do you know, after my son was born, I did briefly have the thought that maybe I'd like a career change and become a midwife, because I found the whole thing so beautiful, and just the you know, the job that the midwives do is so incredible. And then I just thought, I'm incredibly squeamish and can't be doing with a sight of blood, so it's probably not the job for me.
Yeah, I mean, you could just sort of stand in the background and get a lot of praise, but not sort of do anything.
That's my approach to life generally.
Sure, okay.
That's what I'm generally trying to do. Have you thought about what would happen if will you have some kind of vibrate alert on your phone? What if your wife went into labour while you were on stage?
I mean, what an ending to the show. That's me running off, isn't it? No, my friend Katie is doing my tech, so my wife has her number, And yeah, we'll just have SOS sort of signals.
And will you tell the audience in advance?
I don't think so. I might just run away into the sea and just sort of and see how people think about it.
They'll think the show's been going badly.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And it'd be a good thing to have that. I mean, to say that to the audience in advance, I might get a message that my wife's... And then if it is going badly, you could give your technical person the nod. And then
let's get out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think if I do have to cancel the run halfway through, I'm going to film the show in the first few days, and then if people turn up, I'm just going to sort of play the video. And because I'm doing a free fringe thing, they can still put money in the bucket because they're now paying for the upkeep of my second child.
And what is the show?
So it's about my dad and my son, and about male role models and toxic masculinity and that kind of stuff.
So you're not accusing either your dad or your son of toxic masculinity?
No, my dad is, I think, the role model. I think
is he's, he?
Yeah, I think so. He's a lovely man. And my son is too, so there's nothing toxic about him yet. But well, hopefully...
Why is your dad a role model?
He's just wicked. He's sort of... So born in the Valleys in 1953. And I think his life could have gone down a path of sort of quite turning into quite a sort of toxic man. But to various things, it didn't. And he's just been a... Yeah, he's a lovely man. And a lot of comedians my age to kind of do a sort of quote dead dad show where their dad has just passed away and they sort of talk about their father in this kind of love letter. And I thought it would be a nice idea to do while he's still
live
around.
Live dad.
Yeah, live dad show.
Robin, you've brought along some ideas.
Yes.
Let's have the first one.
There's been a lot of debate about all male presenting sort of teams and things like that. I know you feel quite seen here. but I think that's okay if there are all male presenting teams, but they should promote a kind of a positive male sort of friendship or bonding. So
that's what we do.
Well, absolutely, this is it. I hope that
we did a high five and missed.
It's a little thing
joke.
That we've got going.
Yeah.
I think there'll be a whoosh sound. It'll be great. I think there are, like, obviously, you guys. There are examples of that, but I think certain shows could be kind of slightly tweaked to make it slightly more positive.
You think about shows that perhaps could be, just off the top of my head, maybe about cars or cooking.
Sure. Yeah. Right. I think cooking, sort of MasterChef, is one where they're quite sort of like it's food, but they're blokey blokes. Whereas I think if they present the judges, John and Greg, the food at the end of the episode, like John should have to like feed Greg the food, just like in a really sort of tender way, just like really Hugh Edwards just holding Thomas Schaffernacker's hand.
Ed and I have done that thing where we've eaten spaghetti but had
beautiful.
At the end of a strand each.
Great. But that I'm sure that was lovely.
Yeah, I'm in favour of sharing my feelings, but
not your spaghetti.
not your saliva.
that's good, actually. Well, we are quite, I mean, just to sort of display our wokeness for a second. We're quite conscious that we're two men, aren't we?
Yeah, and like we'll never have an episode. We never have an episode where it's just us and other fellas.
Mannels.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think... So do you think there's kind of an excess of this kind of blokey bloke?
I think less so now. I think it is getting better, but I think equally as kind of... there was something in the news relatively recently about ITV banning all male, not banning, but like making sure that all of their writers' rooms for comedy shows weren't all men. And that kind of got twisted into, they ban the men from being in here.
Right.
Whereas I think there's, definitely a step forward in terms of making things more equal. But I think as a result of that, certain people are doubling down on their kind of masculinity and it's seeming becoming a bit of a sort of gender war.
Right, yeah. There's also a problem as well in some of the male-female presenting teams with the roles, when
sure.
the woman is just there to sort of simper a little bit.
Yeah, just boys.
Yeah,
waggy finger thing. I think it'd be good because, TV and radio and podcasts and all media, it's good to see this kind of representation. If you don't have it in your own life, it's important to see it and hear it in other...
Good.
Yep.
We'll definitely
that
buy that.
Yes.
What do you have next, Robin?
The next one is, I think we should put more money into the arts and music, specifically so that one day someone within Britain can write a Hamilton-style musical about Ed Miliband.
Oh, I love it. I mean, I'm tempted to have some music lessons myself, so I could do it.
This is it. This could start here.
I wonder if I should absent myself for this part of the discussion.
Yeah. I think it'd be great. I think future generations...
Edward Samuel Miliband. Yeah.
That's it works.
Good. Yeah,
it works. I've
does.
Thought about this. It definitely works.
Lin-Manuel Miranda might be available.
I mean, he's not returned any of our emails.
No.
This could be it, though. This
so
could be the little missing
piece
of puzzle.
You've seen Hamilton, I take
I've seen it. Yeah, I listened to the soundtrack a lot before I saw it. And then me and my wife went a couple of years ago.
Did you enjoy it?
I thought it was spectacular. I mean, far too expensive, ridiculously expensive, as
it
is all theatre.
Nice to have Gordon Brown on your side.
See, this could work. Edinburgh Festival next year. Let's put it on.
This is good. Yeah.
This could work.
There's something in this.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, would you be up for a cameo as yourself?
Yes.
Yeah,
there we go. There's Ed's famous high pitched voice when he says yes, but doesn't mean it.
Briefly.
Yeah. So musical education in this country needs to improve dramatically so that we can.
I think so. It's from sort of the earliest age. I remember sort of music lessons having a big Casio keyboard that we all just pressed the demo button on and it just sort of had some sort of hip hop beat. But I think if we get in musical theatre and rap.
Aside from yourself, Ed, is there a figure in British politics that you would enjoy seeing a modern musical about?
Theresa May? Boris Johnson.
I see the Theresa May thing more as a sort of interpretive dance piece than a musical.
Through wheat.
Or sort of Marcel, sort of, mime sort of thing,
All right, well, Miliband the musical.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll have that. What else you got, Robin?
Gender reveal party. So my wife, as we say, is pregnant, and we got asked if we were doing a gender reveal party. We're not. But I think I find them quite...
I've never heard of this.
So
I've not really. I've sort of vaguely...
It's quite an American concept that I think we've sort of taken over a little bit. So basically, I think the couple don't find out the gender of your... new baby, but you find, so the doctor writes it down, you pass it on to a friend, your friend invites everyone else over to find out what you're having, and they don't care, and then they release pink balloons if it's going to be a girl, or blue balloons if it's going to earn more, and then that's kind of the that's the thing. So I think these gender reveal parties, I find them quite smelly, but I think if basically it's kind of paint or balloons. I know.
Yeah,
we know we're having a girl.
You knew we were having a boy too.
Yes. We found out both times. I think just,
without the party.
Yeah, absolutely. The party was the scan.
It is a bit weird.
Did you find out in advance?
Yeah.
We didn't, because we wanted to leave it as a surprise.
Yeah.
Just in case that day wasn't exciting enough. Yeah. What were we thinking of, really?
My idea is, if you want to throw one of these parties, they should, rather than sort of balloons, sometimes they really sort of paint or confetti. It should be the paint that they chuck in sort of ransom money, so it stains you for like 30 years. So you've really got to find, you really want to know that you want to do this party, because it will impact your life greatly.
Why would you... I mean...
It's bizarre, yeah.
I mean, try. No offense to any of the listeners who've done gender reveal parties.
Yeah, okay then.
I basically agree. I'm not sure about these gender reveal parties.
And Robin, did you have one more idea?
I do have one more idea. So this is if I'm going to say the B word, I apologise. If Brexit does happen, I think we should unite the country and get everyone in the United Kingdom leavers hoodies, like at the end of college, with all the names of like everybody who voted for everything and like all the architects of it around, and all we can go around Europe and everyone can sign it, like "Gonna miss you, lol, France" on the back of it and that kind of thing.
I'm wearing a sweatshirt with like Boris Johnson's name on it.
Yeah, but very small. Like, there's also
you're saying all the other European countries would sign it.
Yeah, I think so. There's a big sort of farewell.
So, you know, the last
thing.
Day at school, everybody signs your shirt. Did you not have that at your school?
No.
In the last day in the European Union, we'd get all the other member states to sign our shirts.
Yeah, I think so. It's a nice bit of farewell.
It's a bit sort of dystopian. Not dystopian, a bit sort of bleak, isn't it?
Well, it's like having a leaving do.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And we'd have them as sort of souvenirs.
I guess so, as a time...
I mean, I hate to kind of tempt fate here, but I sort of fear you might be giving Boris Johnson some ideas. He's going to produce...
seem to have any of his own.
40 million sort of, you know, Brexit Day sweatshirts that everyone can wear, sort of souvenir, you know, get your souvenir thing, money-making scheme for the government. You can get a sort of, you know... there'll be sort of some special kind of special collection signed. Wasn't there going to be a Brexit?
There were, I think, Brexit. Was it coins or t-shirts with the original March date on that are now?
But also, wasn't there some Theresa May Brexit?
Wasn't she going to buy the Queen
exhibition
a new yacht
or something?
Oh right, yeah, there was going to be a festival, wasn't
festival,
there?
Festival, yeah, festival of Brexit, yeah. I'm not sure. I think it might still be.
it sounds hellish.
We're not sure that your sweatshirts are really helping with this situation.
I can't see it as a moment of national unity, the Brexit festival.
When you see this pitch, you're going to regret. This is my Dragon's Den idea, and you've not gone for it, and you're going to regret it.
Yeah, that is probably true, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Robin, thanks for coming around to my house.
Thank you.
To share these ideas.
Thanks for having me.
Your show, what is the venue in Edinburgh?
It's called The Pear Tree. It's on the Laughing Horse Free Fringe.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Whoa, we're in the outro.
Yeah, well, it's been...
Wimbledon fortnight. We're in the middle of Wimbledon fortnight. I know that means a lot to you. We've been talking about women in sport.
Yeah, I don't really follow it. Has Cliff Richards got up and sung a song? Is that an annual event?
That's only when it rains. It seems to rain less. And also they've got a roof, retractable roof on the centre court. I've been to various sporting events in my life, but there's something about the atmosphere at Wimbledon.
Wasn't there an incident with you at Wimbledon?
Well, there was
got half a memory of you.
Well, there's one
you've been photographed at Wimbledon.
Well, there's one where I was with the Andy Murray's first Wimbledon, where I got invited, and I was there with David Cameron, Alex Salmond, and there was, it's not the first time there was a sort of unfortunate picture taken of me, apparently looking contemptuously at David Cameron or Alex Salmond, but I don't think I was really. That's just my resting face. It was more like, "Where's my seat?" I think,
right? Yeah.
Than anything else. But actually, when I went, when I was significantly younger, and I think I saw Boris Becker on centre court, and it was like a queuing up jobby. And I got on centre court, and I remember thinking the atmosphere was just really amazing. Something sort of cauldron-like about it. I mean, do you not remember these, the rivalries, the players of your youth, our youth? Martina Navratilova, Chris Evert, Billie Jean King,
I remember
Boris
names.
Becker, Jimmy Connors, John McEnroe,
I remember
Bjorn
the names,
Borg.
Yeah, I remember, the poster of the tennis
player.
Do you
not love tennis?
No.
You obviously don't. Right, okay, well... I'd like to thank...
Sorry, the trouble is, you're just such a jock and I'm just such a nerd.
Exactly. Revenge of the nerds. Right, we'd like to thank Baroness Sue Campbell, Christine Newhall, Katie Huey and Kate Nicholson.
And thanks to comedian Robin Morgan. Emma Caution produces our podcast with research from Joel Pearce and backup from Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the idents at Seed, composed the music and the artwork. There we go, we're done.
He's been a bolt fiend.
He's been a cable noggin.
Not Vince. And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.